Welcome to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here for WPR News, and we have a great guest for you today, Bruce Spangenberg, who is the UW Extension Educator for Iron County Horticulture and author of the weekly column Northwoods Yard and Garden. He has some advice for keeping your garden looking good as we pass the midpoint of the gardening season. And I hope you will join in with your calls or your emails. What questions are on your mind? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Bruce Spangenberg, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
You're writing a garden column. Tell us about that column and where can people find it?
Yeah, it's called Northwoods Yard and Garden. It's a weekly column I write based on calls and, you know, requests for information we get, problems we're seeing during the season. But it is year-round. It is on our website for Iron County. So one option is you can go to you can just Google UW Extension Iron County, or you can go to iron.extension.edu and click on horticulture, and you'll see the weekly column, and they're archived. It started back in December when I started here. It's also in three papers up here in the north, the Lakeland Times out of Minocqua, the Iron County Miner out of Hurley, and the Superior Telegram out of Superior.
Pretty cool. And here we are in the middle of summer already, and I'm sure you're writing about that.
Hard to believe.
How'd the first half of the season go? I mean, we talked at the kind of the beginning of the season.
Yeah, we were up at Bayfield Blooms. Well, I think the number one thing, obviously, is rain. I mean, this year compared to last year, it's just completely different with all the rain we've had. It's tapered off a little bit, but certainly rain brings on a number of things. Overall, it's very good because we had such a deficit based on last year with the drought and even going into the year before. And then now, you know, we're seeing a lot of benefits. We're also seeing some of the problems, you know, some of the diseases. Apple scab, for example, I know you probably talked about that earlier this summer on the show with other people. It's been a big problem because the wet, cool weather brings on different problems. Apple scab is one of them, which is very common on crab apples if they're susceptible. It's also on apples. Diseases like anthracnose, which are pretty common on trees like maples and shade trees and on oak trees. Very good for weeds, of course. That's the other thing.
Yes.
Good for plants, good for weeds. But I mean, certainly overall, I think people aren't complaining if you look at this season versus last, just because of the drought that so much of the state had a year ago.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think there were some, we've gotten a lot of questions about tomatoes on Garden Talk and several related to blossoms and not having a lot of blossoms on their tomatoes at this point. Would the rain have created that kind of a problem?
It can. You know, again, too much of a good thing. You need water, but and also a lack of heat. Maybe downstate's had more heat than we've had up here in the north. We've had very few hot days so far. Now, we are getting a stretch now. We're getting more sunny days, and it was pretty warm yesterday out in the sun. It's going to be warm this weekend. So I think you'll see a turnaround, you know, on tomatoes. But, yeah, a lot of rain can cause that problem, cooler weather, you know, a lot of vegetative growth, especially if you've got fertile soil combined with that rain. You know, your plants might be very high, even taller than normal, but just not setting fruit yet. But that should change once the hot weather sets in.
Well, we'd hope so. And diseases that we ought to be looking for with tomatoes in our wet kind of season?
More of the leaf diseases like early blight, septoria blight, which the typical symptom would be the lower foliage. You see, you know, brown spots, yellowing of leaves, browning leaves, leaves dropping off. Now, some ways you can combat that, mulching helps a lot because some of that is caused by soil splash where the fungi do splash from the soil up onto the plant. Lower leaves tend to stay wet longer, so it's more favorable for the fungi. You can use fungicides if needed to make sure they're labeled for tomatoes and use the proper timing and rate that the label says. Increase the air circulation will help too, get more air flowing through. That'll help leaves dry off a little bit faster. And when you are irrigating, try to irrigate the soil and not the foliage. That also helps But if it's raining, not much you can do. You know, a lot of rain, unfortunately, or humid weather, that's very good for the disease. So that is a trade-off. And the other thing we're going to see, we saw a tremendous amount last year, and we'll see it again, is blossom end rot. You see that every year. It's not technically a disease. It's more of a disorder. But it is tied into soil fluctuating, the moisture in the soil fluctuating. Mulching helps. Watering on a regular basis helps. And you tend to see it more on the first fruit sets, and it tends to go away as the season advances.
Yeah, I was thinking about that with the, you know, there are times where we get just tons of rain, and then you've got a week with no rain, and then you get tons of rain, and that's kind of a setup for blossom end rot if you're...
Yeah.
If you're,
it is. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, the not having... even amounts of water each week.
That's the key thing, right? And it technically, you know, it is tied into calcium, but moving into the plant, but that's dictated by water movement. And once in a while, you get tremendous amounts of rain. You'll see odd things with tomatoes. You'll see it on cucumbers sometimes where they just kind of balloon out because they took in so much water. Sometimes that happens with cabbage too, where it's, you know, uniform soil moisture, and all of a sudden you get a ton of rain, and the plant takes in all that water. I mean, that's out of your hands, but certainly mulching is something we always recommend. And if it doesn't rain, uniform moisture through irrigating.
If we miss planting some vegetables, or maybe there are some vegetables that are kind of over in the garden, is there time to get some seeds in the ground?
Absolutely. That's another thing people tend to overlook. We've got time. You can do things like the real short-term crops like radishes, but even, you know, you can plant even something like zucchini, plant it in July and you'll have a fall harvest. You can plant lettuce. You can go with even some of the, something like cucumbers you might be able to get away with, beans. Peas is another one you can get. They like the cooler weather as you advance into fall, especially if you're in the southern part of the state. But even here in the north, you can plant here in July. You can't do the long-term crops. You know, you wouldn't certainly start tomatoes now from seed or something, but, you know, radishes, carrots, beets, green beans, peas, zucchini, those are all options you can go with.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, the kind of leafy things, lettuces and so forth. I mean, even if they didn't get to full maturity, I mean, I kind of like those young, immature leaves and so forth. As you know, just pick them off and eat them, and they're pretty good tasting.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, you can. That's where the whole microgreens, which has become a big popular thing too, with in vegetables, a lot of leafy vegetables. But yeah, we still have quite a bit of the growing season left, and you will notice a couple things when you plant in midsummer. The soil is so warm, you're going to be surprised how fast seeds germinate. You know, sometimes we plant in April and May, some of the even the early crops. If the soil's cold, you know, they're having a hard time getting started. But here in July, that soil's warm and they germinate pretty quickly. And some of the weed pressure is actually less as we move through the summer compared to early summer. And some of the insect problems too, we don't have, like squash vine borer. You don't have to worry about that on your zucchini as it matures in August and September as compared to June and July.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, let's take some calls. You can join in. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email to talk@WPR.org. Erin in Lake Mills, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. I have several pumpkin plants that are large and have lots of flowers. However, I only have one fruit. So I'm wondering if I need to fertilize or what might be going on.
Lots of flowers, but only one fruit in Aaron's pumpkin patch.
Well, one thing to keep in mind with the vine crops, have they just started blooming for you, or has it been quite a while? Is it just the last week or so?
No, I'd say they've been blooming for maybe 3 weeks or so.
Okay. Yeah. Because one thing to note is you have separate male and female flowers, and the male flowers are bigger. So the male flowers come out first to try to get the pollinators coming in, and the female flowers come later. And the easiest way to tell them apart, the female flowers are smaller, and you'll see the miniature fruit, which is actually the ovary right behind it. So you see that little pumpkin. So you should see, as the blooming time goes on, more and more of the female flowers starting to show up. So it is normal to get the male flowers. You see it with cucumbers, the same thing. You see it with squash. And sometimes people are concerned because you see the all kinds of blooms and no fruit sets because they're all male flowers. But then as we move in, move on a little bit, you'll see a better balance and you'll see some fruit set. So I wouldn't be, as long as the plants look healthy, I would not be concerned about fertilizing. I would just watch them, and you should see a better ratio of female to male flowers. You should see more fruit set on there as we go along.
Yeah, actually fertilizer might work kind of against you a little bit.
Yeah, especially nitrogen, because that's going to promote vine growth at the expense of flowers. So.
Well, if she had both male and females there, Bruce, could she do a little Q-tipping on her own? Or
if there's no pollinators around, but again, that's the other, normally with the vine crops, because you get those big male flowers out first, the pollinating insects get on a regular basis showing up, so you really don't have to worry about it. But yeah, that's another thing you could do if you're absolutely, you know, if you are seeing the female flowers and you're just not getting any fruit set, maybe there's aren't enough insects around. So yeah, you could take a Q-tip, get some pollen off the male flower and dab it into the female flower, and that could help. But my guess is it'll correct itself.
Okay. Aaron, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. Our guest, Bruce Spangenberg, UW Extension Educator for Iron County Horticulture. Questions for him, or maybe an experience to share in the garden? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Just a reminder, at 12:30 today, nationally known garden expert Melinda Myers will stop in to talk about the new low-maintenance plants that you might try and that you'll be able to see at State Fair, at Wisconsin State Fair this year. So looking forward to that as well. Right now with Bruce, you've got ready answers to your gardening questions, or maybe share some experience with us at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Annuals can look a little ragged at this time of the year. What should we be doing to keep them looking good through the season?
Well, one thing ongoing would be to deadhead them. And it depends on the variety. Some of them kind of deadhead themselves, but deadheading is just taking the old blooms off, because what some of those flowers will do, if you leave the spent or the bloomed out flower on there, they're going to put energy into producing seed and not more flowers. So if you keep plucking off those spent or bloomed out flowers, the plant will keep sending more. And a lot of the newer ones, especially a lot of the petunia lines, they kind of take care of themselves. You don't have to do that compared to the old days. But the other thing you can do right about now, if you have not done so, it might pay to pinch them back, which would be to kind of not just take the dead flower off, but pinch back into some of the live tissue on the stems, and then give them a shot of fertilizer, like a balanced fertilizer or a liquid fertilizer. A lot of them you can just mix in a sprinkling can and pour it right into the container or the hanging basket, whatever it might be. And even take all the blooms off at one point and say, well, it may look, there's nothing to look at there for a few days, but it kind of reinvigorates the plant. So if you kind of deadhead it, pinch it back, give it some fertilizer, you kind of get another spurt of new growth there, and you get a lot more blooms going into August and hopefully well into September before the frosts come. So yeah, it kind of helps. They do get a little ragged, especially in hanging baskets. There's a lot of plants in those, and over the course of the season, if you're just watering them, they run out of energy, they run out of reserves in the soil, so that's where a little shot of fertilizer helps, and pinching back the plant can help it a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. One thing about the potted plants, the ones that I have out away from my porch, are I haven't had to water them at all, hardly, this whole summer because of the rain. But the ones on the porch, I'd pay a little more attention to the watering on those for sure.
Yeah, sometimes we forget that when you got a hanging basket and it's under the overhang, it's not getting the rains. And the other thing you find, some of those plants, I've noticed on some of the ones that I have, the foliage is so dense. When you get a hard rain, a lot of that rain doesn't get into the pot. It sheds off the foliage, and then you go out there the next day and test the soil, and it's actually dry. So, so everyone's a little bit different, but keep an eye on them. Make sure they got a good amount of water as we get into hot weather.
I have one sort of rectangular pot, I guess you would call it, but it's the one that the squirrels like the best. And I've given up, you know. I thought, why are you replacing those? I mean, replace, and then like the next day they're gone again.
Yeah.
This drives me crazy. Oh boy. Well, what's happening with shrubs right now?
Well, that's a good question. One of the things you want to watch out for, again, it's hard to believe we're well into July already, but we are actually past, you know, the days are getting shorter. We're really past the peak growth time for trees and shrubs. Even though they're still green, they actually are starting their processes for winter dormancy. You know, it's kind of depressing. You get to the first day of summer, and then a week later, the days are getting shorter. We don't notice it yet, but plants already are noticing. It's actually the increased dark that they respond to. So what you want to be careful of, is don't do any real major pruning. I mean, you might still have a little bit of time here, but not too long. Once we get in August, I would hold off for sure. Because what you might do, you know, when you prune a plant, its natural response is to put on new growth. And you might interfere a little bit with that winter dormancy process, even though we're still in summer. And then the plant responds by putting a lot of new growth on that may not harden off properly. And then you set it up for winter kill. So be careful with that. I mean, like I said, a little minor pruning is not a big thing. But if you've got some major pruning to do, you might want to think about, well, maybe I should do it next year and just let it be to make sure it hardens off properly. You can still plant shrubs, you know, especially, you know, smaller shrubs that are in containers. And as we've advanced through the season, you know, different garden center outlets, different nurseries may even have some end of season sales and stuff they don't want to overwinter. So you can take advantage of that. You know, again, we're only in the third week of July, but that's coming up here as we move through the summer. You can think about, you might get some deals on some plants, you know, but like always, choose a plant properly, make sure it's suited for your landscape, that kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. Anything on disease? Have we seen much in the way of disease?
On shrubs, it's been pretty quiet, you know, knock on wood. And that's the case, you know, a lot of shrubs don't get serious disease problems, but, you know, probably the things that you might be seeing this year a little bit more, depending where they're located, you know, if they're in a spot near the foundation that gets a lot of water, that's going to promote some of the root rots. You know, Phytophthora is one of them that it's a disease that's really associated with wet soil or poorly drained soil. And sometimes we see it like you have a line of yews along a foundation or a rhododendron or something growing there. And one of them looks fine and one of them is wilting and dying. And the one that's wilting and dying is sitting in the wet soil. So pay attention to that. You know, where's the water drain off the roof? Where's it drain off the driveway? That kind of thing. Because sometimes you get a spot where it's really wet and that does promote, you know, Phytophthora is one of them. One of the root rot diseases that we do see because of that. But otherwise on shrubs, you know, a lot of minor leaf diseases, if you look close enough, you might see something there, but it's really not a serious concern. You might see some of the anthracnose that I mentioned earlier on some of our shrubs. And you might see powdery mildew as we get into some of our days here. We're not, you know, mildew, you think lots of water. You don't need a lot of water for powdery mildew. Just dew and humid weather is enough to initiate it. So you might see that on lilac, for example, some of the varieties that are susceptible. And there again, some increased air circulation can help. Sometimes it's, you know, we get a lot of plants in an area, there's not a lot of airflow, and we correct that, and that's enough to take care of the problem.
Yeah. Arnie in Plainfield has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Arnie.
I'm wondering if it's too late to fertilize your fruit trees. I have apples, plums, cherries, pears.
Yeah, I would hold off. That's another thing, you know, we mentioned with shrubs, don't do a major pruning because that can invigorate, get the shrub to produce a lot of new growth. The same thing could happen on a tree with fertilizing. Kind of a rough guideline is the 4th of July. In other words, fertilize early in the season or wait. You do run the risk. You could stimulate that tree. And some people debate this, but it is possible that you could stimulate some growth going in winter, and then you set yourself up for winter kill. So if you think you need to fertilize your apple or your cherries, your fruit trees, I would wait and do it next spring. And also be real careful, especially in apples, because that's another call we've gotten a lot of this year is poor flowering on apples. In fact, I did one of my columns on it a while back. One of the reasons is too much growth. You kind of think, well, that doesn't sound right. My tree's growing a lot. Isn't that good? It's good for the tree, but it's not good for you if you're waiting for fruit. So be careful on fertilizing. Make sure you really need it. It's good periodically, a balanced fertilizer for fruit trees to make sure they get phosphorus, potassium, as well as nitrogen. But just be careful with too much nitrogen. But at this point, yeah, I would wait. I'd hold off. I wouldn't fertilize late summer. Same thing with shade trees. If you think you need to fertilize a shade tree, we're really past that cutoff now. I would wait till the dormant time. You could fertilize a shade tree late in the fall after it's dropped its leaves, or you could do it next spring. But make sure the soil's not frozen.
All right, Arnie, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. Email from Iris, wondering how do you tell if your plants have insect or disease damage?
That's the question. It all depends. It's an excellent question, though, because there are some diseases and some insect problems that the symptoms are identical. So it's going to take some searching. Certainly, if insects, you have the opportunity in many cases to find the insect, but not always. It might be present. With diseases, especially when they first start, you may get, you know, characteristic leaf spots and that kind of thing. But then as the disease advances, it gets harder to see because the plant's wilting and leaves are turning brown and falling off and all that kind of thing. So it's hard to give a perfect answer on that. But some ways, you know, look closely at the plant, but also do some history or some research on the plant you're growing and see what it's prone to. I mean, you can do that all year round, but, you know, if you're growing a vegetable crop, or you're growing a shade tree or a rose, whatever it is, do some research and see what are the problems it's likely to get. And I'll plug UW on this. We have two great places you can look. You can start with our website. Go to our horticulture webpage. It's just hort.extension.wisc.edu. And you'll see a whole spectrum on there of, you know, lawns, flowers, trees, shrubs. And you'll see then, you can click down, there'll be diseases and insects. And a lot of the major problems that we see here in Wisconsin are already on there. You can get an idea what they look like. The other thing I'll plug is our Ask a Gardener, which is on that same webpage.
Yeah.
You can post your questions. And if you have pictures of problems, post the pictures. And then those get routed to different hort staff and volunteers here that look at those. And then we'll get an answer to you. So any county in Wisconsin, you can do that. If you don't have an extension office with a horticulture staff in it, doesn't matter. Just post it on Ask a Gardener and one of us will get back to you on it.
Makes good sense. Esty in Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Esty.
Hi, good morning. So Madison is now 5A with climate change, and I found earlier this season fig tree that presumably grows in zone 5 to 10. It was just two tiny sticks, but I did plant them, and they are growing beautifully. They have a lot of leaves. They look very, very healthy. But someone that I mentioned that to was saying that I should cover the little tree. It's really a first-year tree. In winter, so I wanted to see if you know anything about that, and when we say cover, what that exactly means.
Sure. Esty, thanks for calling. So Esty has some fig trees, correct, Esty?
Yes.
Good question. To be honest with you, I'm not familiar with fig trees in Wisconsin. I need to, that's a good one to put on Ask a Gardener. I'm not passing the buck, but that gives somebody some time to look at it. That's also the danger of being on the show by yourself without a co-person to bounce it off of. What we mean by cover, what, you know, a couple things. If you know, two issues with winter. One is obviously hardiness. So as you mentioned, you know, if you're in 5A, and that is significant because I know you've had guests on, you know, recently talking about this as well. You know, we essentially zone 3 has basically disappeared right now from Wisconsin based on the last 30 years. So we've kind of moved up a zone. And again, the higher the number, the milder the winter. So based on the last 30 years, zone 3 has kind of faded away. So that's one issue. You know, if a plant is zone 5 and you plant it in zone 3, you're asking for trouble. It's not going to survive. But the other issue, even if the plant is hardy, some plants have difficulty getting through winter with things like desiccation or drying out. And that's one of the issues with roses, why we protect them. It's not just for the cold, it's to protect them from drying out. So when we say cover, that could be something like rose cones, you know, something like that to prevent from desiccation. It could be straw, you know, put on after the ground starts to freeze and the plant's gone dormant. But to be honest with that, I have to do some research on figs. I'm not, you know, I don't know off the top of my head exactly what you do with that. My guess is you let it harden off and then possibly cover it with a rose cone or cover it with straw and then uncover it in the spring. The other issue you bring about when you start covering plants with straw is you get mice and other rodents in there during the winter, and then they chew on the stem, and then you got problems there too. So
You want to wait till the ground's frozen.
Yeah, right. You know, there are some hardy figs. I don't know much about them, but it could just be you leave it alone. You don't have to cover it. But I would, to double check that, I would either call, if you're in Dane County, call the Dane County Extension Office. There's horticulture people there to help you. Otherwise, post that on Ask a Gardener, and then we'll get back to you. That's something I need to do some research to give you a 100% answer.
Esty, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Mary in Oshkosh next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have magnolia bushes, not trees, they're a bush, and I'd like to trim them, but I don't want to trim them too late in the season, and I'm wondering how late can I trim them before, so I'm not cutting off the buds that are set for the next season.
Yeah, excellent question. These are probably star magnolias.
One is a cup, so it's more like a tulip.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, the general rule on the spring shrubs, spring blooming shrubs, is if they bloom before mid-June or Father's Day, you don't want to prune them when they're dormant because the buds are formed already. And the general rule is try to prune them within 2 weeks of when they bloomed. So if that bloomed back in May, at this point, no, I wouldn't prune it because you're going to cut flower buds off. I would wait till next season and then prune it right after it bloomed or within 2 weeks after it bloomed. You know, unless you got a broken branch or something, or you just want to thin them out. But I would wait on those until after they bloom next spring.
And Mary, you had a question about lilac as well, or was it the same question?
Same question as with lilacs. How late can you trim them?
Roughly 2 weeks or so after they bloom. So there again, I would guess you're past it, unless it's a real late bloomer, which I doubt. So to play it safe, I'd wait till next year after they bloom.
Do you have a pretty good sized lilac bush there, Mary?
It's a lilac tree, so it looks like a lollipop. I trim it up like a lollipop every year. And I trimmed it about a couple of weeks ago, so that I probably wrecked it for next year.
It might be okay. I mean, we're playing percentages. We say 2 weeks. I mean, you probably could go beyond that. But to play it safe, that's the rule, you know, to get the best results. You're probably okay. But I wouldn't do any more this year.
Was it last year or the year before where I kept getting calls from folks that saying, "Oh, my lilacs are doing a second bloom this year."
Yeah, flowering crabs did that too. It's, you know, it's all controlled by hormones, and sometimes when you get a drought or you get some weird weather pattern, it throws them off. So they thought they went through this downtime of winter, so they start, you know, they get reinvigorated late in the summer, and all of a sudden you got a lilac or a crabapple blooming on Labor Day, which makes no sense.
Mary, thanks again. Appreciate the call. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Christine in Escanaba, Michigan. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. I have a question. Last summer, we had a very strange year with our apple trees throughout much of the UP, where we had perfect apples, no worms. I think the insects were fooled by global warming. And then we didn't have the June drop that where the apple, the little ones drop off. And so we had branches that looked like a great cluster. They were just filled with apples. We had branches fall down, trees fall down. And I'm wondering, is that related to global warming where things just got messed up? Now, we had a huge crop of apples, best we've ever seen, but it seems kind of ominous that we had such a strange year. Is that related to climate change?
I mean, it could be that type of thing. Again, it comes down to everything in the plant's controlled by hormones. So weather would be one factor, obviously, that can throw a tree off. And it's the combination of warm and cold that can do that. Sometimes it's drought and excessive rain that can do that. Some trees just naturally do that. We get what we call biennial bearing, where they just they're overloaded with fruit one year and then hardly anything the next year. What tends to happen, the tree tries to correct itself. So if it has really heavy fruit set, some of the hormones actually in the fruit inhibit flower buds for next year. So the problem with some trees is you get a nice heavy crop one year and you get virtually nothing the next year. The only way you can really combat that would be when you see a real heavy fruit set is try to thin it out. It will help the tree. It will help a more uniform bearing over each season. Whether global warming did that or not, I really couldn't say, but I know it happens a lot. It has, you know, it's historically it's always happened. So it's not something that's brand new. Certainly global warming could trigger that. If the seasons start changing, the apple, you know, the tree could get messed up a little bit, which the other thing won't necessarily affect us in Wisconsin, but global warming as a whole, if you think about apples, you're going to see apples grown. The further south you get, you don't get enough cold weather for apples. They need a cool period over the winter. So if the winters get mild and mild and mild, what's going to happen is the range of apples will advance north. You know, you can't grow apples in this, you know, down in Florida right now, but it may be some of the states where you are growing them, you're going to have problems because you're not going to get enough cold weather during the winter. But as far as your issue, I don't know that that's global warming, but the only way you can break that cycle, if it continues, and my guess is you're seeing low fruit amounts this year, would be if a heavy fruit set occurs next year, thin them out. So that'll help get the tree in better, get in sync a little bit better.
Yeah, that's a good tip. Christine, good luck. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Green Bay and Doug. Doug, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. I hope I didn't miss this question because I just tuned in. But I've got about 20 cedar trees lining my border of my property, and they're 3 to 5 feet tall. And I'm wondering how to keep the weeds down around them. I don't really care if I grow grass around them, but I don't want to keep mowing the weeds down around them. Can I mulch with straw or something?
Sure, you can mulch straw, bark. You can use a number of things. But one thing you have to keep in mind, if there's already established weeds there, you do need to get those out before you put the mulch down, because especially if they're perennials, the mulch is not going to smother them out. But that's the long-term solution to that, would be to mulch versus having bare soil under there. There are herbicides, but I'd be real careful with that. You know, there are pre-emergent herbicides you can put down in landscape beds, like around a cedar tree. But make sure, again, look at the labels real careful to make sure they're labeled for that particular type of shrub or tree that you got there. But the best bet would be, it's going to be a little work initially, get in there and get rid of those weeds, especially the perennials, and then put down mulch. And I'd probably look, I mean, straw would work, but I'd probably look at something a little more durable, like bark, you know, bark chips, something like that, which will hold up a little bit better long-term than straw around, you know, a permanent planting like a cedar. Straw is better suited for short-term crops like vegetables.
Yeah, I think that's very good advice. Doug, thank you, and good luck. Appreciate the call. Fred in Willard, we'll go to you now. Hi, Fred.
Hi, I just had a question. We had bought some little sapling oak trees about 7-8 years ago, and we had lined them up, and now they're quite a bit bigger, and we need to move them, spread them out. And I was just wondering when a good time of year would be to move a tree of that age, I guess.
What kind of oaks do you have?
I believe they're pin oak is what she got, but I don't recall off the top of my head. So.
Yeah.
Ideally, when they're dormant, unless you're forced to do something, like I've had some plants at home I had to move just for a variety of reasons that I, you know, midsummer they had to be moved. But it, given a choice, it's always better to move a tree or a shrub when it's dormant. And if you look at fall versus spring, I would probably do it early spring, just because sometimes when you move plants in the fall, when they're dormant, if you don't get a lot of snow over the winter, then you run the risk of roots being damaged by drying out and that kind of thing. So, you know, when the weather breaks in the spring and the soil thaws out, depending, you know, it could be March, could be April, could be very early May, but try to do it before they leaf out. It's a lot less stress on the plant. It's easier to do. And, you know, the transplant shock is much less than doing it when they already have leafed out.
Yeah, makes very good sense. Fred, good luck with that. Appreciate the call. Bruce Spangenberg, our guest today, UW Extension Educator for Iron County Horticulture. Great to have him with us. Questions? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bruce Spangenberg, UW Extension Educator for Iron County Horticulture. Great to have him back. And we'll take some calls. Becky in Sturgeon Bay will give you a chance. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have some fruit trees, apples and cherry and linden, birch and elm that seem to be eaten up by Japanese beetles. I've seen them, and I've removed them and put them in soapy water. I've sprayed with neem oil. Any other suggestions? And what? How far can the leaves be eaten away before, like, the tree is going to die?
Good questions. Japanese beetles are a tough one. A couple things to keep in mind. One thing favorable, if you will, with Japanese beetles, they most of the heavy feeding is actually, you know, I mentioned we're into the second half of the season, so even though it looks bad for the tree health, it's not as big a concern as something that feeds early. You know, if you compare Japanese beetle to something like spongy moth caterpillar, the, what we used to call gypsy moth, that feeds real early, that's a lot more devastating to a tree than something that feeds later. So even though it looks bad health-wise, it's Japanese beetles on trees are not as much of a concern as some of those early season defoliators. They should be done, you know, in the next few weeks, depending exactly when they hatched out. What you're doing, you know, that can help. But the other thing to keep in mind is you're not going to eradicate them. You can manage Japanese beetles. You can knock the numbers down and go out there the next day and there's more. So certainly keep doing what you're doing. The only other issue with fruit trees, of course, is if they damage the fruit compared to a shade tree. But there's not a whole lot else you can do other than what you already have been doing. And just recognize it's not as bad as it looks. And I know it's easy to say that, but, you know, a linden tree is another one. You see a linden tree in August that's got that bronze color to it, and it bounces back next year because that feeding was in the second half of the season. But, yeah, knock them, you know, do what you can. The traps, you know, I'm sure people have talked about the traps before on the show. We get questions about it. You end up, if you put a Japanese beetle trap right where they're feeding on the plant, you end up attracting more. You know, the joke is put the trap in your neighbor's yard so the Japanese beetles go in your neighbor's roses or whatever. But if it's away from the plants, it might help a little bit. But I don't know that I'd mess with the traps either. I would just do what you're doing there with the soapy water and at least you're controlling some of them. And that's really about all you can do with them.
There you go, Becky. Thank you for calling. Randy in Ripon, we'll go to you now. Hi, Randy.
Good morning or afternoon. I just noticed that around here about by Ripon, I've noticed a lot of bur oaks are dying. And I'm just wondering if there's something, some kind of disease going through them, because I've seen some really big ones just totally, they're done. What's going on?
Yeah, a couple things. One, you know, anthracnose is one thing that we've seen on oak this season, but there is another it's a fairly new disease. There's a burrow blight type disease that fits what you're talking about, where the tree looks like it's in really bad shape. There's not a whole lot you can do about that, but it's fairly new. I know it was in Illinois when I was down there. It was fairly new, you know, within the last decade. And I'm trying to pinpoint the exact name. I need to look it up. But it's not the sudden oak blight that occurs elsewhere, but it's a blight that bur oak is the primary target versus white or reds and blacks. But there's not a whole lot you can do about it. But it is, you know, it is an issue. It's certainly something to be concerned about.
Yeah, it's too bad. It's moving its way north, unfortunately. Alan in Kenosha, your turn. Hi, Alan.
Hi, I've got a bed of rhubarb that was planted over 15 years ago. It's about 15 to 20 feet long. And it was thriving. It's planted in an open area, sandy soil. Generally, every year I would give each root probably a tablespoon of 10-10-10 fertilizer. But last year at one end, the plant started to shrink, and it looks like it's died off. And now, whatever happened to that plant is working its way into my bed of rhubarb. And a lot of the leaves are shrinking. And I'm just wondering if it's a fungus or if it's a bug and what I can do to remedy it. If I do need to dig it up, if it's a fungus or something, do I need to remove the soil and replace the soil? Or, you know, what could be causing it?
Has anything changed around there?
No.
And it's nothing. It's all been stable. It's just the.
Yes, there's lawn on both sides. It gets sunlight all day long. Beautiful plants. It's kind of a ruby red. Even the interior flesh is red. They're not real fat stalks or stems.
It doesn't sound like it'd be an insect if it's starting on one end and working its way down the line.
Yeah, I believe rhubarb, I believe, can get verticillium wilt. I haven't seen a lot of it, but if it's been there, and that would kind of fit the description, you know, if the bed's been there quite a while and it appears to start on one end and move toward or be moving toward the other, it's possible you could get verticillium, which is a fungus in the soil. I haven't seen that on rhubarb. I know it exists. That'd be a possibility. You know, the other thing, why I ask if anything changed around there, I mean, it's, sometimes it sounds like if there's a chemical or something in the soil that it moved, that's a possibility. But, you know, verticillium, I know there's a disease called red leaf disease on rhubarb where they, you know, leaves do get a bright red and then they're smaller and smaller. That's another one. I don't know that I've seen it. I know it exists. Some people have asked about it. What I might suggest, since you have a pretty good size planting, what you might want to do is, that's something that our UW plant pathologist could probably look at. If it is verticillium or something else, they could isolate it and give you a positive ID on it. So if you go to that, you know, I mentioned the Wisconsin, the horticulture webpage, just the hort.extension.wisc.edu. Go on there, you'll see the plant diagnostic clinic. There's information on how to send it. You could send photos, but you can also send a live sample. And I'm guessing if it is something like verticillium, Brian Huddleston, who's our head pathologist there, would want to try to culture that. But it'd be worth doing is if you have that much of a planting, and then he can give you some guidance on what to do. But I'm speculating at this point, but that would be the most serious problem, something like verticillium. And if that is the case, then you probably want to. It's in the soil, so you might, need to replant the healthy plants in another area so it doesn't spread. But Brian could help you with that. But I would start with the plant clinic, because that's an issue. And it goes back to that question someone asked earlier about, you know, how do you tell insects from diseases? Well, sometimes you can't, but lab culturing can help, especially with serious diseases like verticillium and some of the other wilt diseases.
You might even start, well, the UW, if you just type in UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, it's going to pop up. And if you can take some photos of the leaves, particularly, you know, close-ups, that might be enough for him. But you're right. Yeah. He's probably going to want to do some sort of test. But you could start with that. Get some good pictures. Include those along with a description. And Brian's really quick to answer things.
Absolutely. Yeah, Brian is amazing. not just his knowledge, but how fast he responds to us. I've sent him stuff, you know, a picture of something in the morning that I wasn't sure on. And by the end of the day, I've got an answer. So, but some of those do require culturing.
Yes.
You know, to positively tell what you got. You can't always tell from pictures.
Yeah, but get some good close photos of the leaves and the plants themselves, and I think you're going to get some help from Brian. Thanks, Alan. Good luck with that. It'd be a shame to lose that patch, for sure. Bob in Waukesha, we'll go to you. Bob, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a question about lavender plants. I have a bed about 3 feet wide and 4 feet long, and this year they seem to, the buds were there, but the flowers never turned blue, and they got a little overgrown and woody. What is a good time to trim those back?
So you say the flowers just didn't form right, or they kind of stopped?
Well, it looked like the tips of the flowers were ready to bloom, but they never really turned blue.
Okay. Sometimes are they getting shaded by anything, or are they out in the full sun?
They're full sun all day long.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the way to do it.
Yeah. I'm not certain on that one. That's kind of a I'm kind of drawing a blank on what might cause that.
I am too. The lavender, I don't have any lavender, but a lot of my neighbors do, and those plants all look really, really healthy and kind of fun jogging by those, as they smell so good.
Me too. Whenever I see them, it seems like they're flourishing. So, you could type. Usually, you prune them after they're done flowering. But that's another one I don't want to pass the buck. But what I'd say, post it on Ask a Gardener. You know, you mentioned the plant clinic, but also Ask a Gardener. That's something that you could put it on there and describe the problem, post a picture or two with it, and then one of us will get back to you on that. But that's kind of a puzzler, because normally they do well, unless sometimes when they're in shade, maybe so much rain has impacted them, possibly. You know, if they're getting too much water, maybe that's an issue as well. But
That could be, depending on the soil they're growing in, that could be.
Yeah.
That could be an issue. So UW-Madison or UW Extension, ask a gardener and see what you can come up with there, Bob. Thank you for calling. Bruce Spangenberg, our guest today, UW Extension educator for Iron County Horticulture. It's great to have him with us. And you can certainly join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you email. We've got a bunch of email questions. We'll get to those as well. We'll take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the WPR News. And then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here for WPR News. And our guest today, Bruce Spangenberg, UW Extension educator in horticulture for Iron County and author of the weekly column Northwoods Yard and Garden. So questions, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. And let's take a call from John in Stevens Point. John, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I have a stand of pretty healthy lilacs, and they are, they've just taken on this pretty intense uniform brown or rust color, and it's never happened before. So I was kind of wondering if there might be something that I can do or what that is.
So that's just a uniform, the whole leaf has a bronze color to it, or is it a spot or a margin?
The whole plant. Yeah, the whole, the leaves entirely brown or rust colored.
And they're all doing it, you said?
Well, it's funny because I have some that are a little lower in the yard, 20 feet away, and then the ones that are higher don't seem to be affected. But then the lower ones are across the board. And I thought someone had sprayed or something, you know, it's near the road, but it doesn't appear to be the case because there's other plants around it that aren't. That aren't brown, so
yeah.
I mean, bacterial blight is the main disease on lilac, but that doesn't really fit what you're describing. Sometimes, you know, browning rust might be some kind of insect, but there again, I don't really expect that on lilac. Or mite damage sometimes can give you an off color like that, but And these are old, well, they're mature plants. You said it's been a healthy stand there for quite a while.
Correct, like 20 years plus at least. So more like 30 maybe even. So,
wow.
That's a unusual one.
Yeah, that's another. It's the day for those calls, I guess. I mean, if you look at lilac, the two diseases that stand out are bacterial blight and powdery mildew. I mean, those are two. And then they are prone insect-wise. You can get lilac borer, which could cause the whole plant to wilt. But these leaves aren't wilting; they just have a rust color to them.
Yeah, and they're crunchy. I mean, they are like dying. They will not, you know. I think the vasculature is gone in them. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that could be. I mean, chemical injury would be a possibility, but when you're saying the other stuff around it looks okay. Lilac borer or a wilt disease, I mean, that could cause the leaves to turn brown and be crunchy, but I mean, those are pretty devastating problems. Typically they're not just a cosmetic kind of thing. Are they wilted or are they still flat? You know, and the leaves, when you look at them, are they like wilted and shriveled up, or they just appear like they normally would? They just change color.
They're shriveling some. They're not completely, you know, they're shriveling, I would say. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, there's some possibilities. Mites are a possibility, I guess. Chemical injury. Borer, I don't really think so. I think you'd see more wilting, you know, branches just collapsing and wilting if it was that bad. I have not heard of mite problems on lilacs occurring to any, you know, significant level, but that's certainly a possibility. That's another one I'd strongly suggest. Get us some good pictures of it. Post them on Ask a Gardener. Because sometimes, you know, when someone describes a problem, you know, I visualize something in my head. Or if I describe something to you, you visualize it in your head. And it may be different than what you're actually seeing, but a picture would help clarify that. So I would suggest take a picture of the whole plant showing the pattern and then a close-up, a good close-up of the leaves, a couple pictures if you can of the leaves you're seeing, post that on Ask a Gardener. You know, if it's something we can answer visually, we will. If it's something that might, like we talked earlier, might require an additional step to go to a plant clinic, we could advise you on that as well. But that would be the next step. It sounds something like something unusual. It doesn't sound like a run-of-the-mill lilac problem. So that's why I really encourage you to post it and we can look at it.
Yeah, and to get to Ask a Gardener, you just go to...
Yeah, a couple options. You could just go to the Wisconsin Horticulture page I mentioned, you know, hort.extension.wasc.edu. And then when you go to that, the fastest way, there'll be a, some things across the top. I just pulled it up right now. There's a tab that says resources, and then ask a gardener's. Actually, on the very end, it just says ask a gardening question all by itself. And you click on that, ask for your name, what county you live, then you can describe the problem and submit the picture. So just go to the Wisconsin Horticulture webpage. Right across the top, you see ask a gardening question. Click on that. If you want to go to the plant clinic, like we mentioned earlier with that rhubarb, then go to resources, and the second option is the plant disease diagnostic. Click on that, then it tells you how to submit a sample to them. But a good starting point would be ask a gardener, because what will happen if it's something we can handle by pictures and descriptions, and it's done. We can tell you what the issue is and how to deal with it. If it does require an additional step, like laboratory culturing, then we can advise you on that and how to do that.
Yeah. And we'll make sure that's up on our page as well on WPR.org/Larry. We'll have that up. Go to today's date, and you'll find that link there, John, or anybody else for that matter. Good luck. Thank you. Hind in Green Bay, thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Larry and Bruce. My question is, I have these five-leaved Virginia creepers. They're in my flower beds and in my trees, and I feel they're smothering my arborvitae. How do I get rid of them without destroying my trees and my flowers?
Yeah, and that second part of your question, that's the challenge, because you could, I mean, there's herbicides you can use, but you got to be so careful because they will damage other plants. You really have to get to the root of those. I mean, they will cause a lot of damage. You know, some people like them, you know, they do have some ornamental value, but as you described, they wrap around, they smother stuff, they wrap around trees and that type of thing, and they can actually girdle a tree and kill it. So what you need to do is trace back those vines to the ground, and if nothing else, just cut the vine off at the ground. That'll stop its growth, and then ideally dig out that root system later. Like I said, there are some herbicides you can use, but I would be really careful because they could damage the tree or the shrubs, whatever else you got growing there, the perennials. So it really comes down to the manual labor part, but the biggest challenge is figuring out where the root is, because those things, once they start, you know, vining and wrapping around things, it's hard to trace back where they went to. And odds are you got more than one plant that you're dealing with. So it's going to take some work there. But get to the base, initially cut it off, and you'll see the vine will shrivel up and die. And then mark where that root was and go back and try to dig that out as best you can.
Yeah. And remember that the berries, there are berries on those. Those are toxic berries to people and dogs. And the sap on Virginia creeper is also a skin irritant and can create some problems that way. So you need to be a little careful when you're dealing with it. Good luck. Appreciate it. Dot in Manitowoc, we'll go to you next. Hi. Dot.
Good afternoon. 1 year, my neighbor told me about that her tomatoes weren't doing very well. And I said, well, now, take a look at it. They're right next to the grass. And then you apply the weed killer on the grass, and that's being absorbed by the tomato plants right next to it. And that could go for any extended plant that you have next to your grass. What are you applying on your grass that could be absorbed by the other plants? And so now that you have a shriveled up leaves and different color leaves and so many other things. So,
reminder, Dot. Thank you. And you'd agree with that, I believe, Bruce.
Yeah. And there again, you know, I mentioned several times, anytime you're dealing with pesticides, you know, weed killers are one example, you know, read the labels, be very careful. You know, it's hard to say if those, what you apply to lawn, some herbicides have to be absorbed by the leaves, some work in the soil. So it depends on the material. And there's also, you know, if you're using grass clippings in a compost pile, then there's always those questions. If I sprayed my lawn for dandelions and I mow and collect the clippings, can I put those in the garden for compost? And the general answer is no, you want to wait, you know, a period of time. The good news is most pesticides we apply break down fairly quickly compared to the older material. So, you know, they break down by sunlight, they break down by bacteria in the soil. There's different mechanisms that break down the chemical. But, you know, certainly, you know, read the labels, number one, and err on the side of caution, keep the materials away. But I wouldn't be overly concerned that just because I applied something to my lawn, it's going to automatically move into the garden. It depends a lot on the material. Some move in the soil, some do not. And of course, the other issue is direct spray. When you get drift, we spray the lawn and it drifts on our tomatoes. That's obviously going to cause problems as well. So it comes down to, you know, we talk more and more about integrated pest management or integrated plant management. Look at all the ways to manage problems. You know, only use pesticides when you absolutely have to control whatever pest or weed disease that you have. Use them at the right time. Use at least toxic ones, those kind of things. And pay very close attention to the label, because there were information is on there on what you can do, what you should not do to keep, you know, so you don't have problems or things get drifted onto non-targets or damage other plants, whatever it might be.
Adam in Eau Claire emailed. He has a 3-year-old peach tree that he believes has a canker. It's on one of the main branches coming off the trunk and nearly down to the trunk, making him think pruning that branch off isn't possible. He's read something suggesting it's only a matter of time before it girdles the tree and kills it, while others say not to worry about it. The tree will probably overcome it.
Yeah, that. The most common one is perennial canker of peach. There's other cankers, but when you talk about a canker problem, cankers are normally tied into stress. And the stress with peaches, even though we have peaches that are hardy, they're short-lived and they are prone to winter stress here, you know, for us this far north, even further south. You know, even in Illinois, they have problems with perennial canker in southern Illinois in peach areas. So whoever told them that is correct. When you get a canker on a major limb or a trunk, realistically, you can't prune it out, and it probably get worse. Now, it's possible sometimes if we get favorable weather, with cankers as a whole, the tree can kind of do what we call walling it off, and it won't go away, but it may prevent it from spreading on the trunk of the tree, and that tree may hang on. But it is stressed, and the other bad news with peach, there's insects like peach tree borers that come in and attack stressed trees as well. So you are fighting the odds to grow peaches, even though we have peaches that are hardy for Wisconsin and Minnesota. It's kind of a matter of time. They're short-lived and they're very prone to perennial canker. They're prone to winter damage. They're prone to borers. They're all related in the fact that we're on the northern edge of where you can really favorably grow them. So for that tree, you can't do much other than if we get a dry period, water, you know, try to minimize other stresses on the tree. But unfortunately, it's not real favorable as far as diagnosis on that tree.
Mm. Tom in Madison emailed. He has some well-established white gala bushes that have gotten fairly large, you know, about 4 feet in diameter, wondering when should he prune them and how much of the bush can be removed without harm. He's afraid of cutting them so far back that he's left with only dead branches.
I would probably wait till they're dormant and prune them. Now, you're talking about reducing the height or this? You're not talking about actually digging up and dividing.
No, just pruning back.
Yeah. You can prune them back. I mean, that's sometimes what happens if you have a multi-stem shrub, it just kind of gets out of bounds on you. You can cut the whole thing back and they'll respond as long as they're growing healthy. And sometimes that's the only way you can do it. You can't selectively go in there, and sometimes a mistake people make is they cut a shrub down like halfway. They just pick a point and they cut it, and then you get all these buds along that area that you cut that break dormancy, and then you get this bird's nest effect or this witch's room effect, and it gets worse. So I would say if it's just gotten out of hand, out of bounds, and it's a healthy plant, what I would do is first thing in the spring, I just cut it down to the ground, and you may sacrifice it for that year, but long-term, it's going to come back, and you can kind of control it the way you want it to grow.
Yeah, good advice. James in Madison emailed. He planted a witch hazel shrub last summer. Did great last year, and up until a few weeks ago, it started, it was fine, but now it started to turn yellow and has started dropping its leaves. It gets full sun. He thought maybe with all the rain we're having, it may have gotten too much water. He sees no sign of insects.
Yeah, the too much water would make sense. So that's another thing, you know, we've talked about problems this year. the rain has been good, but it's been bad. And weird things can happen when plants sit in too much water. Turning yellow is a common symptom. Leaf drop is a common symptom. Sometimes plants wilt, which is, you think, well, how can a plant wilt when it's getting all this water? Well, it's wilting because its roots are struggling because there's no oxygen. So I would think initially that's the issue. He said it was planted last year, do you say?
Let's see, last summer.
Last summer. So it's still in that, you know, that first full year for a transplant is always, you know, it's a new transplant. It's subject to issues with transplant shock. The other thing I would look at to see how that was planted, you know, was it a bare root plant? Was it bald and burlap? Was it in a container? Because sometimes we see issues with, especially with bald and burlap, where people plant the whole, just plant it as is with the burlap on it, and then it comes back later to cause issues. That burlap may be sticking out of the ground. There might be a wire or thick twine tied around the base of the trunk that you didn't see initially when you planted it. If it's a container plant, sometimes if they're been in a container a little bit too long and you plant them initially, look okay, but then those roots now are growing in a circle. So you might get girdling roots. I mean, those are all possibilities, but the fact that it's still in its first year and we had so much rain, I would lean toward that's the issue for it. And it hopefully will bounce out of it as things dry up and its roots get better established. But I would check the root zone real carefully.
This kind of relates to an earlier call from, this is Nancy emailing. She lost a whole stand of mature lilacs within the last 2 years to bronzing leaves and then dead limbs. So okay. there's something out there.
Yeah. Again, I would look at bacterial blight and borer as the two biggest ones, but there's another one, like we mentioned that earlier caller, I think it was John had the problem in Stevens Point. Send us some pictures and maybe send a sample to our plant clinic as needed to look at that.
Yeah, Karen in Bailey's Harbor emailed to remind us that Brian does charge for a sampling. I mean, he doesn't for a photo, but I don't think, but he does charge $20 to do a test.
Right, and that's another reason I would start with the Ask a Gardener, or you can send the pictures to Brian. But if it's not a disease problem, it may be insects, it could be culture, whatever it is, the Ask a Gardener is free. So you can submit pictures, upload them on there. But again, I would just stress the better the pictures, you know, get a close-up, get an overview of the whole plant, whatever's it, and then give us all the information. You know, how old is the plant? Anything recently that's been done there, you know, was it fertilized? Was something else done? Was it moved? If you have multiple plants, are they all showing it? Just certain ones showing it? All those kind of things help us make a better diagnosis of the problem.
Yeah. And Jill, our executive producer, is reminding me thinks he may charge for a photo too. So you need to read the directions when you get
there. Yeah, I think you're right. And also, Jill had sent me during the break a picture of a tomato from, I think the woman's name, I'm looking at an email address. I don't know. It's Reese is the last name, I believe. D, just says thanks, D, capital D. But it's a tomato plant grown in a patio plot. And it's showing what typically we call leaf scorch. Because I think her concern from her description, in the last few weeks, leaves and flowers have been turning brown. We've had lots of rain. She put rocks over the soil mix to prevent soil splashing, but this happened anyways. I don't think this is a leaf disease from what I'm looking at in these pictures. We're seeing what we call leaf scorch, which is a symptom. So you see the margin of the leaves turning brown. And this could happen on any kind of plant. This happens to be a tomato growing in a pot. And normally when you see that, you start thinking about root or stem issues in a potted plant. That could be heat stress. It could have been a sudden change in the weather. Could have been a lack of water. At one point, even though she said we've had plenty of rain, might have been an unusually hot day or something, you know, where the plant responded. There's fruit on the plant that I can see here, but it does not look like a typical tomato leaf disease like we mentioned earlier at the start of the show. This looks more like a cultural kind of thing, something affecting the roots or the soil. I would personally, she's got rocks on here. I would take the rocks off. He or she, I'm sorry, it just says capital D. I would remove those rocks just because of the heat that's going to put, you know, if the sun shines on that rock all day, it's right at the base of the plant. It could get too hot for a container plant.
Nancy had emailed back to say she checked for lilac borer and didn't have it. This is with the lilacs, of course.
Oh, yeah.
She lost 15 feet of lilac border in 2 years. So just wondering if it was a fungus or not.
Maybe some kind of wilt disease or, yeah, something. There again, I would – those plants are gone now, I guess, from Nancy. John is the one that had the ones. I would try to get something to us. We can look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. Dennis emailed to ask, when leaves are brown, should you scratch the bark to see if they're still green and alive?
On a lilac? Or he didn't say, just on a plant in general?
Yeah, he says, Wendley, I think on a tree or a branch, a shrub maybe.
Yeah, that's a good question. Carefully, like if you have leaves turning brown on a twig, you might want to carefully scratch. I would just be careful not to do too much where you damage it. But whether it's a woody plant like a tree or shrub or whether it's a herbaceous plant, that's a good starting point because obviously if the stem or the branches are brown and brittle and the leaves are brown, you know, that's telling you the plant's pretty much dead. But sometimes things happen where the foliage drops, the stem is okay, and the plant's going to recover. So that's a good starting point. And then, of course, the next obvious question is what happened? You know, what's the problem? That's going to take some more investigating. But, yeah, it's a good quick test to do to see, you know, is it a sudden problem? Is it a chronic problem? If it's a chronic problem, the branches are probably brown and brittle. And, you know, the tree or the shrub or the plant's probably past any hope. But if it's green, yeah, it might recover depending on, you know, what caused it and what kind of plant it is.
And just to go full circle on this business with the charges, Brian Huddleston does charge $20 for a photo, a response to that, and $25 for physical samples.
Mm-hmm.
So just to get that straight, pddc.wisc.edu is the place to go for that. And Bruce, we're out of time. Thank you so much. I appreciate it very much, and hopefully we'll do this again down the road. Thank you, Bruce.
You're welcome. Sounds good.
Bruce Bangenberg, UW Extension Educator for Iron County Horticulture. Great to have him with us. Coming up, stay with us. Melinda Myers has some new varieties of landscape plants for you, and we'll be talking about those plants on exhibit at the Wisconsin State Fair. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be spending some time talking about new plants to add to your landscape. And it's great to have Melinda Myers back with us. She's joined in to tell us about some of the newer shrubs and flower varieties added to Energy Park at the Wisconsin State Fairgrounds. Varieties that may work in your garden as well. So if you're looking for some low-maintenance shrubs, aren't we all, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Melinda Myers, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Always a pleasure, Larry.
You'll be appearing at Wisconsin State Fair again this year in the We Energies Energy Park. And maybe for those not familiar with that area, it's a dandy area. Tell us about it.
Well, one of the wonderful things about, there are great containers and gardens throughout the state fair, but we feel like we have one of the best green spaces. Lots of plantings, lots of good information for you to obtain. We're located just south of the big, huge Ferris wheel, in case you have trouble finding us. That's a good landmark at the fair. And so one of the ideas there is to help people find a little you know, a little break from the heat, learn something about gardening and energy savings. And Discovery World is there doing some solar-powered pollinator insects kids can decorate, make, and take with them. So lots of fun things to do as well. And we had to do some changing, just like everybody, right? You plant some things, they don't quite work out. We had some shrubs that did a little too well, and they were blocking some view, some sight lines that we needed to keep open. So we thought, well, you know what? You got to do it eventually. So we decided to make some changes, introduce some new shrubs and some other plants, just to kind of help all of us get some ideas if we need to spruce things up a bit.
And I before we go too far here, I wanted to make sure to tell people that you make many presentations at State Fair Park. Let's go through some of the what are your presentation times and topics and so forth.
You bet. So I'm going to start out the day at 10:45 talking about attracting hummingbirds. So our feature garden that changes every year, Dawn Stark, who works with me, has been managing the garden this summer and filled it with beautiful pollinator-friendly, but especially hummingbird favorites, because I know we all like to bring them in. Feeders are a great way. I'm going to talk about how to do that. But we have a garden that's filled with plants that you're going to want to add to your garden. At 1:30, I talk garden challenges. So, you know, people always want to get answers to their questions, just like when they call you, Larry. And so we're going to talk about some of the top problems that I'm seeing, that others are seeing, and, of course, answer questions. And then I'll finish off the day at 4 o'clock with new garden plants at Energy Park. But they're all the plants, the new additions and the permanent plantings are labeled, and there's a map available on the other side of my handout. So even if you can't make it to my new plant talk, you can walk through the gardens and find some of these new varieties.
And there's a lot of new varieties out there, and hydrangeas, there's so many choice. Let's start maybe there. There are so many choices these days. We have some new varieties to bring to a garden.
You bet. And I think one of the challenges has been with the big leaf type hydrangeas. You know, we see these big pink flowers or blue flowers in Southeast United States, and we want them in our garden, and they've introduced repeat blooming hydrangeas like the Endless Summer, and they haven't always performed as well as we'd like. Maybe we didn't get the flowers that we wanted. Well, a new addition from Bailey Nursery, located in Minnesota, is Pop Star, and we've got a sample in the garden, and this is one that reblooms earlier. So what happens is the old varieties only flowered on old wood. So what do they do in the north? They die back to the ground, so we get leaves and no flowers. The rebloomers bloom on old wood if it survives, but also on new growth. But they seem to bloom kind of late or didn't perform as well as most gardeners wanted. Pop Star is more vigorous, blooms longer. It's a knock your socks off. It's beautiful. Got one donated for the gardens. I had to go out and buy myself one, too. I'm like, I need one of those. Hardy in zones 4 to 9. Morning sun is perfect for it. It's a little smaller, too, 18 to 36 inches, probably more like 2 feet in our area. So it's one that if you're looking for a reblooming big leaf hydrangea, check out Pop Star. The other one is Eclipse. That's another big leaf one. And it has dark purple leaves. So it's the first one to have dark purple leaves. And they really set off for us. Down in the southern part of the state, we'll have pink, kind of cranberry-colored blooms. So that's a nice contrast. If you have acid soil, they'll be more blue. And so you get some pretty foliage as well as flowers on that one. And then the panicle hydrangeas. You know, Limelight was a wonderful one. We had one in the gardens. We finally took it out because it got too big. Yes, I'm like every other gardener, thought we could keep it contained. It was the star of the show, but it just blocked the view. So Tiny Quickfire is a new 18 to 36-inch tall panicle hydrangea. So Quickfire is popular. This is a dwarf form, white flowers that turn pink, and it has fall color. So those are the three new hydrangeas we've added to the garden this year.
Looking forward to seeing those for sure. Well, let's turn to some other. I was surprised to see a bleeding heart on your list. That isn't usually a spring bloomer.
You bet. So, you know, we always try to focus on plants that are going to flower during State Fair. And you're right. We think of bleeding hearts not only as a spring bloomer, but also in the shade. I was lucky enough to visit Walter's Gardens and saw these pink diamond fern leaf bleeding hearts in full sun in bloom. And they talked about the importance of growing it in full sun. And they were kind enough to donate a plant. I said, I have to take these to our state fair because people will be blown away. Blue-green leaves reminds me of Luxuriant or King of Hearts. Pretty pink flowers and nice leaves, but blooms nonstop throughout the summer. Hardy in zones 3 to 9. So pretty much anyone in Wisconsin, if you can find the plant, and it'll become more available as time goes on, but a nice one as well. The other one to consider, bred by a breeder at Intrinsic Perennials, the owner of Intrinsic Perennials in Northern Illinois. It's a perennial plant of the year in 2023. A 2020 All-America Selection winner is American Goldrush Rudbeckia. And I don't know if you grew Goldstrom Rudbeckia, a popular plant years ago. We all loved it. Bright yellow flowers, great pollinator bird plant. But it succumbed to leaf spot, and it really ruined the look. So we'd have flowers. It wouldn't kill a plant, but it was the ugliest looking plant in the garden, right? So American Goldrush is disease-resistant, nice and compact, 22 to 26 inches tall. Mine's just beginning to bloom in my garden because, of course, you know, when I'm looking for additions for State Fair, I have to also look for additions for my yard, like any gardener.
Sure.
And so it should be we're hoping it'll be in full bloom for State Fair. So that's another good one. And then we've got a couple of native cultivars of native grasses as well. Blackhawk, you can tell the breeders from Northern Illinois, big blue stem, and it's got green, dark green leaves that turn deep purple and continue to darken through the season, 48 to 60 inches tall. And then a little blue stem called Little Red Fox, it's only 24 to 30 inches tall. So nice one for smaller space as well.
Wow, that's there. Did we talk about hibiscus yet? I can't remember.
I know, sorry, and I just kept going. So, so hardy hibiscus, I don't know if you have some in your garden, Larry?
No, I don't.
Okay, these are the ones that have the dinner plate size flowers, and they're hardy, which is great, throughout most of Wisconsin, zones 4 to 9. Summerific is a new group of hardy hibiscus introduced by proven winners that tend to be a little bit smaller, only 3.5 feet tall, big 8-inch wide blooms.
Wow.
And I know. And so those are the knock your socks off of the garden. And so these are great options to have if you want something midsummer into fall and you've got those beautiful blooms. Many have some colorful foliage. All Eyes on Me hardy hibiscus is the one we've got in the garden that has blushing pink blooms, and they bloom along the stem, so not just at the tips. And then a hibiscus that is a shrub form is the Rosa Sharon. Kind of, I think of my grandma, she had Rosa Sharons in her garden. And the newer varieties, like the Pillar series, are narrow and upright. So it really gives you more options. You know, it might make a nice screen, a hedge in those small spaces. And we have the Red Pillar series of Rose of Sharon. And so that's a hardy hibiscus. Hummingbirds love it. Hardy to zone 5. So our northern, sorry to those of you in the northern part of the state. Very heat and drought tolerant. So it's once established. So some nice additions to the garden as well.
Melinda Myers, our guest, gardening expert extraordinaire. And it's fun talking with her today about some of these new plants that we can all try. And you can see at the Wisconsin State Fair this year. Questions for her? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Hope you can join us on Monday on the Larry Mueller Show. We'll be talking about how the Ice Age shaped the St. Croix Valley, and then we'll get an update from the weather guys. So it must be the last Monday of the month, this coming Monday, for sure, if the weather guys are there. Right now, we're talking with Melinda Myers, and she's been filling us in on the plants, the new plants that we're going to be seeing at the Wisconsin State Fair. Questions for her? Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And speaking of emails, Mark emailed to ask how and where to find new plant introductions that she and that you and others mention if they haven't been made it to the local nurseries yet.
You know, that's a great question, Mark. I was at the Ball Horticulture Field Day for their customers, and lots of cool new plants, and that question came up, where do you find them? So a couple of things. If you have a good relationship with your garden center or area grower, let them know you're interested and maybe get your friends. One of my favorite new annuals are the Soiree of Vincas. They're an annual vinca, and like the flamingo has double flowers with ruffled petals. Doesn't even look like the annual vinca. And we have kawaii in the garden this year in some pots. And it's been one that a lot of Wisconsin gardeners have had trouble finding. And so I'm trying to get the word out as well. I'm working with growers to try to set up retail spots, you know, available from these retail locations. So part of the onus comes on us. You know, growers need to know that they can sell what they grow, so it's kind of a risk to do new plants. So if we can, as gardeners, especially if you have several of you, say, hey, if you grow it, I know we can, you know, get X number of people to buy it or whatever, that's one thing we can do. I'm continuing to get the word out so that, you know, sometimes it takes a couple years. I have some favorite tomatoes that I have to start from seed because I haven't found them in the retail locations yet, some of my favorite All-America selections. So sometimes it's starting annuals from seed. It's asking our favorite garden centers to start carrying them. And sometimes we have to do mail order, too. You know, there are sometimes more and more places will ship plants. Always check, you know, are they a good resource? You know, I always try to shop locally first. We want to support our local garden centers. But sometimes if it's a new plant, you may need to find out. I know some of the growers or some of the breeding companies also have retail sites, or they'll tell you where it's for sale. So I understand, Mark. I always hesitate. I always like to wait. Well, it's been on the market a couple of years, and it's probably going to be available. So I agree with your frustration. We were saying, where can we buy some of these plants we saw yesterday?
Bill in Bayfield has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Bill, hello.
Hydrangeas, a small hedge of them. And when we bought the house about 4 years ago, there's a small azalea bush, and both of them had behaved normally until this year. But now both of them have developed what I call sucker growth. I don't know that's the technical term or not. But these are offshoots. They come up from the ground or just by the stem of the bush, and they're both twice as high as the woody part of the bush. The leaves are twice as big as the other ones. And what should I do about them, and what could be causing that?
Great question. So a lot of times with plants that tend to send out multiple stems, we call them suckers. Think about red twig dogwood and forsythia. And we typically leave those and take out the older stems. But plants like your azalea, it sounds like your azalea and hydrangea have an established system. So what might be happening is you're getting sprouts from the roots. Now, some plants are grafted. Typically not these, but you never know, where they take a hardy rootstock and then they take cuttings or buds or the variety they want and they put it on that hardy rootstock so you get the plant you want. You can just basically, because it's so much more vigorous, it might outgrow the plant that you're trying, you know, that you like, that looks good, is shaped like you like. Cut that back just below the, if it's not attached to the trunk, below the soil surface, and that helps reduce the risk of it resprouting. And you can do that right now is a good time to do it, and that can help control it. I'll tell you, this year, you know, after 2 years of drought, boy, plants in my yard have really taken off, you know, lots more growth. Of course, the weeds have too, but my shrubs are bigger. You know, they've really put on a lot of growth. And I'm wondering if your top of your plant looks fine, and this, I would just prune that off and then kind of monitor it as well. And, you know, it might happen again. Take care of them as they appear.
Sounds like a plan, Bill. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. You did have some fun plans for kids and adults alike, I think, don't you?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, we're talking about hard-to-find plants, but also to talk about annuals. This is where you start your list so that you go, next year I'm going to buy. And I think we all have those, right? And so for kids, I have grandkids, and so I always am thinking about kids and love to get kids excited about gardening. So the sensitive plant, I think any gardener likes this one. This is in the mimosa group, and you touch the plant, and it folds up. And it also folds up under low light conditions. And basically, when you touch it, that pressure or that change in light causes a rapid water release from the cells at the base of the leaflets. I had to look this up to find out what makes this happen, right? And they close up. And then peanuts. You know, we are not the peanut capital. That's more of a southern, right? But they're cool plants. They're related to peas and beans. They have yellow flowers that form on stems above ground. Once they're pollinated and fertilized, those flowers push through the soil, and that's where the peanuts develop. And you know, it's kind of like when I harvest my onions and potatoes, it's like a treasure. For me, peanuts, right? I found transplants at various garden centers. Usually you can find them available, and I don't have a huge harvest, but usually enough to give each grandkid a peanut, and grandma usually gets one or two, too. So. But it's one of those cool plants that just has a unique growth habit.
Someone else is wondering, what happens to these plants at State Fair the rest of the year? I mean, you know, State Fair runs what, you know?
Yeah, 11 days.
11 days, I was trying to remember.
So that's a great question. We leave the gardens intact, and obviously the shrubs are going to stay. I bring a lot of planters from my home, so I transport those before fair, and then they come back on my patio because those are my plants. And Growth Country Garden brings containers for us to display, and then, you know, they take those back as well. Lots of nurseries, Ebert's donates flowers, and they'll stay. And then we leave the garden stand over winter, need to get out there to do some pruning in the spring, and then in early June, usually, the Wisconsin Landscape Contractors Association and some other volunteers come and help us do a cleanup, planting, and get the garden in shape. We don't have vegetables this year. That ended up being a little more challenging. I'll have tomatoes in containers and some artichokes in a pot and things like that, because harvesting and keeping up with them. So these are permanent plantings, and then the annual stay, and we clean up at the end of winter, and then the containers that are mine come back to my house so I can enjoy them the rest of the summer.
Oh, my gosh. Well, State Fair has got to be all-consuming for you, and I've watched you work, and you're not only making presentations, but afterwards you're answering a lot of questions, which I think is great.
And you know what? It's a lot of fun. It is 11 very intense days. We no longer have a chef at Energy Park, at least not this year, so they've named the kitchen Melinda's She Shed. they keep me fueled with water and some of my favorite caffeine sodas, and they threaten to put a cot in there if needed. But I love meeting with gardeners. You know, we both learn so much, right? You learn something from your listeners. I get great ideas I can pass along. We have lots of laughter and fun, and hopefully help people have fun and be successful in their garden as well. And there's lots of things going on in Energy Park, beautiful gardens, places to sit. We have benches out there. You can sit and relax. The kids' activities, they have the hard hats for the kids, you know. And so just lots of fun things that you can enjoy that space in between all your other fun activities out on the ground.
And for the kids, isn't there a sensitive plant, too, there? I don't know. I think you mentioned that.
Yeah, that sensitive plant that when you touch it, the leaves fold up in response to that touch that makes that. So I have a sand bucket. I love to use sand buckets for planters, for kids' plants. So I have one I'm bringing along. I did put another one in with a vinca and a geranium that seems to be doing well, so I might bring both of them along. So Monday is my day to go, this one's fair worthy. This one needs to stay on my patio.
Oh, boy. So as we're getting near the end here, but we've still got a couple of minutes. What other things have you got going beyond now? Once State Fair is over, you're back to other things.
You bet. And so if you visit my website, melindamyers.com, not a creative name, but hopefully it makes it easy to find, I'll be doing some presentations. Actually, take a little bit of a break from working with the public, resting up, and then I will be doing some talks in September and a webinar on fall care and planting for your landscape. That will be a webinar, so anyone can tune in, and of course it will be recorded. And that happens to be on September 12th, Fall Landscape Care and Planting, sponsored by Fresh Coast Guardians and hosted by the Milwaukee Public Library System. And so then I'll also be doing Art and Fleurs, which is a wonderful event, the Garden Clubs of America, but the public are welcome. And I'm going to be doing Adding Native Plants to Your Landscape to Help Protect Our Waters, and that is September 11th. So if you visit my website, there's a link to that information as well. And then I'm heading to Ebert's for their fall festival on the 21st, and Pasquazi to talk on the 7th. And Pasquazi's in Lake Bluff, Illinois. So
you got lots going on.
I do. So that's good. That's good. I get to hang out with gardeners throughout August and September.
Jerry had sent us an email. Her zucchini fruit isn't growing. They get 3 to 4 inches long, and then they stop growing. Wondering just what could be the cause of that.
You know, I was out looking at mine. I had some blossom end rot. You know, we know about that with tomatoes, but peppers and squash and zucchini will get it. And sometimes with all this rain, what happens is that bottom end of the fruit turns soft and doesn't fully develop or rots. So one thing to do is make sure, you know, little zucchini are tasty. So if they're nice and firm but not developing more, consider picking them. Weather influences a lot. You know, we had all that rain and then it's been a little drier. And so that can influence the development of fruit on our vegetables. So I would say if they're 3 to 4 inches long, they make great, they're great tasting, hopefully. Not too tough of a rind. I would harvest them to encourage more fruit. And then I think as the weather, we get a good rain again, depending on where you're at, we hopefully you'll have some things kind of start producing more of the normal size zucchini.
Okay. Melinda, it is a great pleasure. Have a lot of fun at State Fair. Hope to see you there. And good luck.
Okay.
Wear comfortable shoes. You're going to be doing a lot of standing.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Melinda. Melinda Myers, she's as she said, she's many times she'll be talking through the course of the day. She's got several talks during the course of the day at Wisconsin State Fair. Great to have her back with us. Just a quick mention, next week we'll be talking to Vijay Pandian about growing blueberries. What do you think of that? Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's always a treat for me and for the rest of our crew. And we've got a nice crew of people. Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our technical directors, our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, and of course, our executive director is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Have yourself a great weekend, but stay with us right now. Lots in store on Wisconsin Public Radio News.